Good evening. At this time, we begin the second man on line lock. I'm K2RIW. And with the help of K2KEY, Mel, we try to answer people's questions. These are gathering of the clan that takes place here at this time. Mel and Dick don't have all the answers, as you'll soon find out. But by way of the help of the people who are also listening to the TechNet, we normally get 90-some-odd% answers for people's questions. The main purpose of the TechNet is education with reference to ham radio subjects. 26 different kinds of ham radio already exist, and more are being invented. This way you see the results in a few years with the computer software-designed radios. You're going to be hearing more and more about that. As I said, the main purpose is education, and therefore people usually find out something about wireless products, how to make them work better, how to have more fun with them, what are the other 25 kinds of ham radio from the one that you're using, and should you be trying it. That gives you a little bit of a rundown of what we do. The subjects of interest to the TechNet are any subject of interest to wireless experimenters and ham radio operators in particular. There's also a written service that has existed for some time that has been misinterpreted. And so we have to reinterpret that from time to time. In other words, for the brand new amateur or potential amateur who doesn't have a license yet, doesn't have an easy, convenient way for signing into the TechNet, he's listening to us on his scanner receiver or a loaned receiver from somebody. As he writes a letter to Mel, K2KEY, most of the time he'll get an answer. However, we are not offering a free consulting service, and it has been misused in that manner. We get people who want us to do their high school homework and their college homework and read their doctoral thesis. It's a nice left-handed compliment that Mel and Dick are believed to have the ability to do this kind of work, and it's really above and beyond the call. What we're volunteering to do, to repeat, is to have a live discussion of the gathering of the clan, of the subjects of interest. And so the main subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are the subjects you bring by way of your question. Occasionally, Mel will have a canned program on something like how do decibels work and how to use a Smith chart. But with a couple of those relatively rare exceptions, the subjects that are discussed other subjects that you bring. Okay, with that introduction, do we have any check-ins from people who have a question or a comment? A typical sign-in would sound like this. WS2N, Paul, and yes.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Gotta wait for the beep. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters, your name, and that's confirming yes if you have a question or a comment at this time. Go ahead. 2FLF. FLF. Okay, we got FLF, we've got KC2MDP, Steve, and Mark, and Rich, and 2EO. Anyone else like to check in? Give me your call letter's name, and that yes at this time.
KC2SK, Myers, no question at this time.
Okay, and Gene, I think we heard you. We'll get to you in a few minutes. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name, and I confirm a yes at this time. Okay, Laura. Laura, was that a yes or a no?
Yes, I have an announcement.
Okay, Laura. Laura, with the announcement. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is WS2S Paul. With a no. Good evening, sir.
Very good, Paul. I've already got you checked in, so to speak. Anyone else?
Here is Kilo Charlie 2, Delta Echo Papa. No question,
please. Okay, DEP with a no. And one last call. Anyone else with check-ins? Give me your call letter's name and a yes or a no.
KC2FK, Myers, no question.
KC2FK, I think it was. And I think it was with a no.
KC2FK, no. That's correct.
Is that Sierra Kilo Echo? Am I hearing Sierra Kilo? Sierra Kilo Echo?
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Echo, confirmed.
Okay, SKE with a no. Rich, N2EO, you're number one on the runway, so right ahead.
Okay, Dick, I didn't have any questions. Why don't you pick up all this announcement and go on to the next person, because I don't have any questions, Dick, just checking in, N2EO.
Okay, thank you. This is regarding KCRA, Kings County Repeater Association. On Tuesday night, 8 o'clock, there's going to be 15 minutes of 5 words per minute Morse code. Then that will be followed by 30 minutes of general class theory and questions for those that want to upgrade to the general class license. On Thursday night at 8 p.m., there's also 15 minutes of 5 words per minute Morse code, which will then be followed by 30 minutes of extra class theory and questions for those who want to upgrade to extra class license. The frequency is 146.430 megahertz, positive 1 megahertz upshift, and a PL tone of 1365.
Okay, all of it came through that time, about the KCRA. Anything else you want to add to that, Laura? Go ahead.
Negative, negative. But if there are any questions, people can feel free to email me at my call sign, Kilo Bravo 2, Victor, Delta Victor, at ARRL.net. Thank you.
Okay, Kilo Bravo 2, Victor, Doctor, Delta Victor, at ARRL.net. To get a hold of Laura for any further information about the KCRA code proficiency test. Let's see now, of the people who signed in, Rich had a no, Steve had a no, Mark had a yes. That's the FLS. Go right ahead with your question. And maybe our questions are a little bit late tonight, so take your time, Mark, K2LIW.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me okay, first of all?
Loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about the Hurricane Gloria generator, the wind car, I believe it was. Somebody suggested to me that it was really a light-duty type generator and wasn't designed to run. Since you were the gentleman who was the guru on this way back when, maybe you can enlighten people listening that did pose this question. Nick?
Yeah, that sounds like a significant misquote, Mark. The Winco, W-I-N-C-O generator, Earth Energy Systems, is the parent company of Winco, and I think they're in Wisconsin, allowed us to buy from them 525 of those generators, if my memory is right. I'm blaming it out. The price was 525 originally, because we were buying in such mass. I think we bought roughly 500 of them. I'll have to double-check that. It is an industrial commercial rated engine, Tecumseh engine, industrial commercial rated with steel sleeves. It has free fuel capability. It can run on natural gas, liquid propane, or gasoline. And in the original way it was issued, the natural gas regulator was included. It also has an electric starter. The electric starter is a bit difficult to use. It requires a very low resistance wiring to the 12-volt battery and a healthy 12-volt battery to start it. But it has an electric starter, a pull start, a 220 output connector, a pair of 110 output connectors, circuit breakers on all of the above, a low oil indicator with automatic shutoff. Trying to think what else it had. I see no reason why it wouldn't run in an industrial environment for the exact same length of time before a wear out of almost any other kind of generator of a similar type. It's built into a cradle with a shock absorber mechanism. The dangers that I was telling everyone about at the time to avoid, make sure you do not run it indoors. Even though you think you've established a real good exhaust system, when you drop it, get the beep. Even though you think you've installed a very good exhaust system, because there is significant shock-mounted vibration of a generator like this, a one-cylinder generator running at 3,600 RPM, you will get, from that vibration, metal fatigue of almost any kind of an exhaust system you can create to exhaust it outside the house. And when that metal fatigue takes place and exhaust gases are pumped into your house, that could be a dangerous condition. On top of that, no smart human being would ever use gasoline indoors to a living quarters. If, for instance, you spilled one cup of gasoline onto the floor of your basement and waited until it evaporated, and if a spark came along and ignited that vapor, there's a medium good possibility that the roof will be removed from your house. Extremely dangerous material, as you can tell. So do not put gasoline inside of the house. Do not bring a generator in the house. Even if you use it in a garage with the open garage door open, the garage door open, make sure the wind is blowing in the right direction. Even that can become a dangerous condition. It's an outdoor machine. So considering what we bought, what it was promised to be able to do, as I said, both 220 and a pair of 110 with circuit breakers built in, I don't know why a person could not use it in an industrial environment. Back to you, Mark. Mr. SOS, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, here we go. N2FLF. Yeah, the person I was talking to, might have been concerned that you couldn't run it for like 24 hours straight or whatever. But I did call up the company last week, oddly enough. Because I just changed the oil in mine last week. Had a question or two. I didn't know where to put the manual. I know it's here. So I called the horse's mouth. And basically I had asked him about the muffler. He said that, I asked him if I can get like a small car muffler, like a four-cylinder car muffler, and do a little rigging and put it up there. And I said, would there be any back pressure problems or anything like that? You know, being that particular muffler is designed to handle a four-cylinder car, there really should be nothing. And he said, no, no problem. You know, I've heard of that done before. Not going to have a problem at all. I'm going to make it one heck of a lot quieter. So, which was quite interesting. And when I get around to it, I'll do it. But, you know, that's not going to happen for him. It's like antenna work in the winter. All right, thank you very much. Very informative, as usual. And I'll be listening here. And 2FLF. Take.
Yeah, if someone said you cannot run it for 24 hours, he's talking about the fact that it's got a one-gallon tank. And that every hour and a half, you're going to have to refill the tank. During one of the outages I had at my house, I used it for 24 solid hours by filling the tank every hour and a quarter or so. The 4 kilowatts, if you manage the appliances in your house properly, at least in my house, that will run furnace, refrigerator, significant number of lights, television set. If you're using only one burner at a time, it'll run an electric range. You gotta run around and make sure that everything isn't being turned on simultaneously. And even if that does happen, if you get a whole lot of lights, a television set, and a burner being used on the stove, and you happen to be unlucky that the furnace wants to start and the refrigerator wants to start simultaneously, so that you're drawing, let's say, 7 kilowatts on a 4 kilowatt generator, the generator simply stalls. You overload what that 8 horsepower engine is able to do. Nothing dangerous happens, from what I can see. About the most dangerous thing I think you can do is to have things wired in such a way that you have to, of course, disconnect you from LIPA or Con Ed before you can power your house. Obviously, the fact that if you're still hooked up to LIPA or Con Ed, and you turn on a generator and feed the house, you're trying to pick up your whole block, if you know what I mean. No matter how many kilowatts you've got in the backyard, you're not going to be able to do that. You've got to disconnect yourself from the grid, let's say. However, when power comes back on, you see the lights on across the street, and then somebody flips the switch such that you're now powering your house from Con Ed or LIPA, and the generator is still connected, and you're now feeding the generator, you're back feeding it, and you could create some damage there. There are diodes in the rotating armature that you might damage. It's a repairable situation. But try not to backfeed 110 volt power into a generator, whether it's running or not running. I recommend you do not do that. So there's a couple of obvious things along these lines that have to be done. The sophisticated way is to have a real transfer switch, which either draws power from the grid or draws power from the generator that's in your backyard, one or the other, a single pole, double throw-like switch. That's the right way to do it. Unfortunately, that's a $350 piece of hardware with proper installation. Before the installation charge, just the hardware itself. Therefore, the majority of us will make up some kind of an extension cord and backfeed the house. Now, the smarter guys will backfeed the connector to the dryer, which runs on 220. And that way, you're feeding the whole house properly. But not so sophisticated guys will use the 110-volt output connector at the backyard, let me drop, and backfeed it. The disadvantage of doing that is you're only feeding one phase of the house. Each house has two phases, so to speak. In other words, your 220 line coming in has got a neutral center. It's got a red and a black lead. Each red and black lead is approximately 120 volts to ground. But red and black are out of phase with each other, and therefore 240 volts between them. So if you only feed the red versus ground or the black versus ground, you're only feeding half your house. And half your blinds will work and half of them will not. Well, the next step that a ham will do is to put the two phases of the house in parallel with each other, so the generator is feeding both. I've done that. But by the time you do that much jumper lead attachment to your main circuit breaker panel, which is not an easy thing to do, by the way, by the time you've done all that, reversing it and putting everything back the normal way, when you go back to connecting to the grid, there's a number of ways you can make some mistakes. I've done that once and ended up putting 120 volts across one of my clip leads, and that was an exciting event. But for a person with your amount of electrical background, Mark, that shouldn't be too difficult to figure out. I wonder if you have any other further questions. I'll turn it over to you, and then we'll jump over to the net if they've got questions or comments. N2FLF, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that pretty much covers it, I tell you. Oh, one more thing he did tell me, that that unit and the units up today, they're still made proudly in America. All the good stuff is here. And that's it, Dick. Over to you. And to a collect.
Yeah, let me tell you one other thing. If you're using non-multi-grade oil, and I, by the way, have developed a strong dislike of multi-grade oil, 10W30, 10W40. Most of the world thinks that's the best thing invented since hot bread. I strongly disagree. And maybe I'm unique on this one. You take a look at the Toyota automobile failure report, and you find out one of the major failures, I'll say a Toyota Camry, which I own, is that the engine will develop what's called the gel problem. In other words, the oil will gel in some of the channels because the oil wasn't changed frequently enough. Multi-grade oil is great if you change it every 3,000 miles. I change my oil once every year, whether it needs to be changed or not. And when I have somebody change the oil, I tell them, you will put in 30-weight straight oil, non-multi-grade, non-high detergent, straight 30-weight oil. And they tell you the manufacturer doesn't recommend that. We don't guarantee the results. I said, I'll find any release in the world. You're going to put that oil in my automobile. As such, I don't have the coagulant, which breaks down and forms into a gel and a sludge and whatever. I mean, my engine, like everybody else's engine, is up to temperature in about 60 seconds, so that the multi-grade oil is only helping you during that first 60 seconds. Well, during that first 60 seconds, I don't put the engine under heavy load. Whenever anyone does any repair on any of the engines I've owned for the last 15 years, they open up the oil pan to change an oil seal or something like that. They say, boy, you must change your oil every 2,000 miles. I've never seen an engine this clean. I say, it's that clean because I'm not putting the sludge in it. You see where I'm coming from here. Use the right oil in that generator. You don't have to change it very frequently. The one thing you do have to worry about is if you leave fuel in the carburetor bowl, it will form a sludge. And the needle valve mechanism in that carburetor is a bit difficult to get to clean. I've gone through that process. So I do recommend you either put some kind of a stabilizing substance into the fuel when you pack it away for the year, so to speak, that you're not going to use it, or make sure you run the bowl completely dry. So try to make sure there's no fuel in the bowl of the carburetor left there for more than, let's say, a month. Other than that, I've had no failure. I've now owned it since 1985. That means I've owned it for 23 years, and essentially no failure. I've heard of no other failures. It's a rather ruggedly made machine of not Cadillac. In other words, because we bought them in bulk, we paid $525 for them way back in 1985. We didn't get the Cadillac machine of the Rolls-Royce repeater. We didn't get the Cadillac or Rolls-Royce machine with all the horns and whistles. But within that price range, I know that we got a lot for our money. I know of no one that's complaining about them. And I would have been the first person to hear the complaint. So I don't think you're going to run into a problem, Mark. Let us know how it works out. As I said, I've used mine for 24 solid hours on 1.5 occasions. 24 hours one time and 12 hours another. A number of guys have used them at field day sites for the 24 hours of a field day operation. That's been done a number of times. So they have a history. As I said, it's an industrial commercial rated engine. Very few people, I'll admit, have run them on liquid propane or natural gas. But a few have. The majority have run them on gasoline. Anyone with any further questions on the Winco generator, 500 and some odd of them appeared on Long Island in 1985, right after Hurricane Gloria. Any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Well, one more quick comment. He did tell me to use a good grade of 10W30.
Okay, Mel, I'm hearing an awful lot of noise on your signal tonight, Mel. Something is different about your transmitter. Okay, but someone told you to use 10W30. As long as you drain the oil out of there every year and change it every X number of hours, that's the right stuff to use. But not all of us are that diligent on our oil change. Some of you guys are. My family is not. My family is notorious on forgetting the oil change for some ridiculous length of time. And therefore, I'm not in favor of multi-grade oil. But I know I'm in the minority. And everyone has accepted this stuff without question. I have taken apart engines of mine where I have used multi-grade oil, and I misused multi-grade oil by waiting too long between oil changes. And when I ran a very long drill into the pushrod of the rocker arm assembly of an Oldsmobile engine to clean out that hardened sludge that came from that multi-grade oil, I said to myself, I'm never going to use that stuff again in this family. You forget for some significant length of time, like 3/4 of a year, with that stuff, in my opinion, you're in a lot of trouble. Yeah, a certain percentage of the people don't have the ability to get in on the East. That is not programmed in the rig. I heard Eugene very well on the input. Eugene, you did not come through the machine, but I heard you very well on the input. And what I did hear you say is that you're running a satellite television receiving system, and you want to build a second dish, if I understand correctly. And you want some information about how to build the dish, the feed on, and so on. Among the really serious 10 gig and 21 gig microwave type ham radio operators, using the 18-inch dish that they can buy on the surplus market, or even brand new from various sources, they have used those very successfully as 10 gig and 21 gig, 24 gig ham radio operations. And if you go to the website of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.net. I'm pretty sure it's not .org or .com. I think it's .net. Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.net. Tom Williams, one of the microwave mavens in the New England area, on that website has got all kinds of information similar to what I think you're looking for. However, I'm not sure now if you're trying to accomplish satellite operation for ham radio purposes or satellite operation for further television reception, like a second receiver in the house. If it is television reception and second receiver in the house, I strongly recommend you not build, but you buy, because the price of the parts is so extremely low. So I may have misunderstood you, Eugene, and if so, straighten me out. W2EWK. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's very good. W2WK. I bought a FM radio receiver, and I'm trying to make a better antenna because the antenna calibrate is like a pack of cigarettes. So I want to make a bigger antenna just like get a bigger signal into the dish. USL?
W2TTT, quite noisy. I'm hearing you on the input from New Jersey. Stand by a minute, Eugene. Let me find out what Mr. TTT is saying. K2LAW. You'll be interested to know, Gordon, that your signal is coming through my input frequency very well. I'm hearing you on the input. I am not hearing you through the machine. And I think you said you're offering us 146.555 from the Palisades. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. I think you're saying if people transmit it on that frequency, by some means it'll get repeated here. Give me a little bit more information on that, Gordon. W2TTT, who I'm listening to on the input. K2LAW, check that. I think what happens is that at this time of night, Gordon is mobile in motion in New Jersey. He attends a Boy Scout situation each Sunday night, and so he's at various locations, probably on the Palisade Parkway, and for a while he came through very nicely on my input. He's no longer coming through my input and not coming through the machine, so unfortunately we're not going to easily hear what Gordon is saying. So what Eugene is saying is that he's got an XM radio. The little antenna that comes with it is about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and he's unhappy with the performance of that antenna, and he wants a better antenna. Now, to my knowledge, XM radio, at one time I knew what frequency they're on. Would you be able to tell me the downlink frequency here, Eugene? That's the first step. You'd be amazed how many people think they're going to set up a parabolic dish antenna for, let's say, 432 megacycles, which is thoroughly inappropriate, which I could explain later. So if you first tell me what you believe is the frequency of reception for XM radio, which I should know and I don't, I can give you some advice from there. Back to you, Eugene. K2LAW.
Okay, thank you. I do not know myself. It's not actually XM, it's stereo, stereo. I said XM by mistake though, but I meant stereo. But I haven't taken it apart as yet, but maybe one of these days I'll take it apart to what's in there and see how it is made. But I'm very curious to see if I can make one better than the company has made one. QSL, W2, EWK.
Okay, so it's Sirius, not XM, but still, you desire to make a better antenna than the one that was supplied, and I can understand that. And by one means or another, we're going to have to find out what frequency Sirius XM satellite, mobile radio, television, reception, what frequency they're on. Let me toss it over to the net. Does anyone know what downlink frequency those two services are using?
3 gigs. Delta Echo Papa.
Okay, somebody said 3 gigs. Somebody said Delta Echo Papa. Delta Echo Papa, give me the full call and the name and proceed with your info.
All right, Dick. First, I'm going to make it a repeater.
Very well. Please proceed.
Okay, excellent. Name is Charlie. Call is Kilo Charlie 2 Delta Echo Papa. Sirius operates with two different downlinks, 11.7 to 12.5 and 12.5 to 12.75.
Okay, those are exactly the right frequencies for the so-called 18-inch dish. And my guess is those services have two things in their favor compared to satellite television reception. The satellite television reception in the 11 and 12 gig region is able to do it on a 12-foot dish, a 18-inch diameter dish, an offset-fed dish, and it's got a couple of dB of fade margin, so to speak, and the dish has to be positioned to the nearest approximately 1 degree in order to give proper reception. Obviously, doing that from an automobile is almost out of the question for a typical installation. So, the advantage they've got is they're not transmitting anywhere near the data rate of television. They're transmitting audio, not video. That allows them to use much more narrow bandwidth. Therefore, they can have much smaller antennas on an automobile and get good reception. If Eugene did elect to use an 18-inch satellite-type television reception dish at those frequencies, and those are essentially the exact frequency that dish is designed for, the dish, the feed horn, that's all there. The preamp is all there. It's called an LNB, low noise block down converter. That's the good news. The bad news is that depending on which model number of the LNB you get your hands on, it tends to favor the video frequency range of those particular satellites. And I'm going to have to ask you, Charlie, to your knowledge, is there a shared frequency region between the video services like DirecTV versus XM and Sirius? Is there a shared frequency region, and you essentially select one from the other by way of a particular digital code or polarization or aiming of a dish? How do you separate those services? Because they sound at first like they have overlapping frequency regions. KC2, Delta Echo Papa, K2RAW on the TechNet.
All right, not 100% sure exactly if they are allocated to a specific section of the band or are they sharing or overlapping. But I know you can get, whether it be DirecTV or Dish Network, either one, I'm not sure, like I said, one of them you can get XM and the other one you can get Sirius programming. So there might be, some sharing of spectrum or, it might just be not so much sharing of spectrum, but the other user might be using the other one's frequencies for it.
Yeah, I see another possibility here, Charlie. Because your DirecTV and Dish Network and similar satellite services not only supply video, but they used to be, at least, and I presume they're still there, a whole lot of various music channels. Or you can select a channel where you hear nothing but country and western. Another one where you hear nothing but classic and so on. Easy listening. And so they seem to have 15 or 20 different kinds of music channels, which I suspect that they are getting the programming from XM, Sirius, and other services and reproducing it on their format intended for video and audio. Now, in other words, they may be doing it as a kind of, what's the right way to put it now, video-like, but they're only using the audio portion. And by the way, I think you see some kind of a fixed picture when you're watching those services, as opposed to really using the protocol formatting and whatever of Sirius or XM. So it looks like a little more investigation is required here. I know that when you get a low noise block down converter, they come in about three or four different versions depending on what frequency range they emphasize, and also whether or not they're intended for Canadian use, North American use, European use, and so on. So one way or another, we're eventually going to pin down the frequencies of the service that Eugene is interested in, and therefore we should eventually be able to find out which brand name and model number of block down converter you should buy for his particular 18-inch dish. The 18-inch dish, you don't build that, Eugene. You buy it. I can't remember the name of one of these major wholesale houses that will sell it to you for like $12. And don't build a thing like that. There's a tremendous amount of technology you're getting there for $12. All the mounting hardware that steers and azimuth and elevation and polarization, the mounting hardware for the feed horn. In some cases, if you buy that setup, the low noise block converter is included. Even if you buy the low noise block converter right out from some service that sells it, they come out numbers like $25 or $50, nothing really fancy. So an awful lot of this hardware. You buy the right one and stack it together, not very much construction is taking place. The horn itself is already there as part of the low noise block converter. Okay, there's probably some guys out there with a lot more smarts on this subject than I've got right now, but we're learning. Give me your call letters if you've got anything to contribute or ask. KQLIW on the TechNet.
Hey, there you
go. Go right ahead, Eric. And you're the guy that should know. And I think I'm hearing a little bit of noise on your signal, but you're 90% audio, not to worry.
Alright. You know, the XM and the Sirius satellite receivers are actually on SN. They're not up to KU. Although they have their own. There's actually a series of satellites from Sirius. But that's the same thing. The receivers in the far S-band are 1.6 gigs. And there's basically a stream. The ODFM is being transferred. There's also terrestrial transmitters to make up for places where you don't get to see the sky. But DirecTV is in a completely different other place. They're on KU. And they're a whole bunch of actually PPSK carriers. But because there's a big amplifier on the satellite, it's 150 watts.
Okay, Eric. You're 75% audio, 20% noise. 80% audio, 20% noise. S-band is what you're saying Sirius and, Sirius and XM really are, 1.6 gigs. Now, 1.6 gigs is almost a low enough frequency, Eugene, where you do not want to use a dish. It's sort of in the gray zone. At a frequency like, for instance, 900 megs or 432 or 2 meters, yeah, definitely use the IDs. You do not use a dish unless you're way up in the class of a 28-foot diameter moon-bounce array. And then you consider using a dish because it's so broadband frequency, you just change speed horn and you're on a new band. But when it comes to 1.6 gigs, it's really not dish territory. That's Yagi and collinear and things like this antennas. As we study the problem further, and right now, I'm not sure we've got all of the information as to what is the effective isotropic radiated power of the satellite that's sending down to Earth the XM and Sirius signal. A little bit of research will find that out. So that will be able to calculate what is the minimum antenna gain required and noise figure combination. Let's call it gain to temperature ratio of the receiving apparatus, the ground station, to get good clean reception on XM and Sirius. And I presume you're doing this for a home installation where you want some high reliability service. There's a double-edged sword here. In other words, as you increase the antenna gain on a automobile for, let's say, Sirius service, the good news is that when the antenna is properly aimed, you get a stronger signal and higher reliability. That's the good news. The bad news is that by definition, every higher gain antenna must have a more narrow horizontal and vertical beamwidth. Therefore, it requires aiming. The advantage of that simple looking antenna that's the size of a cigarette pack that you're presently using is that when it's properly installed on an automobile, it is covering most of the hemisphere of sky above that automobile. And so therefore, you can go into a parking lot and drive circles with the automobile and still get continuous reception. You might not get continuous reception when you're in the marble canyons of New York City because at times you're going to get significant blockage. In that circumstance, nothing but an adaptive antenna is going to save you. A higher gain antenna when you're in a blocked environment may not be enough. These are some of my early opinions on the subject. Eric, I'm going to pass it over to you to shoot holes in some of the things I just said. KE2EJ, he's got a little bit of noise on his signal, so speak a little bit loudly and distinctly. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Alright, is this any better?
Audio-wise, definitely better. Signal-to-noise ratio-wise, similar. Go ahead.
Different microphone. KQRIW, KQJ.
Yeah, Actually, XM is actually geostationary, by the way. And we need to see how much power the transponder has in it. But actually, the direct satellite is broadcast for digital radio, actually, they call it. It has about 25 megahertz worth of bandwidth, and it's split in half, actually. The lower half belongs to Sirius, the upper half is XM. So the two-thirds is share about Comcast there. The emission from the satellite is strictly polarized, and that's just the same thing about it. Essentially, the antennas that they make, a little finished circuit board antennas with a teeny little bit of gain and an active amplifier behind them. They're very different kinds. I mean, they even actually make one that's a little dish attached to it. The thing with XM is because it's geostationary, you can do a dish kind of thing with it, but Sirius you can't, because those are all LEOs that are going by, and there's a bunch of them that sit by every, where is it,
every 90 minutes?
No, every one pass is like 6 minutes or something like that, I don't remember. Or maybe it's in a sun synchronous orbit, which would give you a bunch of hours, but there's a bunch of them, so issues won't help you there. Keep your eye on your pager, though.
Get back, Golf Zulu.
Something Golf Zulu. Sounds like Phil. Okay, thank you for your information, Eric. I got some comments on it, but let me turn it over to Mr. QGZ first. I'm a little bit slow on the uptake there, Phil. And you're coming through very nicely. QGZ, RIW.
Good evening, WB2 QGZ. The service that has the stationary satellites, my recollection was that they also had some decent space between two that they were using. So one antenna may not give you all the services, or you may be lucky, you may be in a good spot. But the issue in Manhattan and in metropolitan areas is I believe both services, but at least one of them, do have terrestrial repeaters that are rooftop mounted. And that's supposed to fill in holes and all the cracks and crevices where you don't have good sky view. That's all I have. It beats the QGZ.
Okay, it's my wife checking in. Joe recognized, and thank you, Bill, for your information. Alrighty. So, no one has put an adaptive antenna on the car yet, and I presume that Eugene is trying to do this from a fixed location like a home. At least one of the services has got geosynchronous satellite. The other service is using either low Earth or medium Earth satellite, probably low Earth, and they're continuously in motion. So extra gain in the antenna could fight you, could be at a disadvantage. And so if it's home service that you want higher reliability, putting the antenna in the right location so that it's not looking for trees, putting it high enough up on some kind of a mast and using the exact same antenna may be the more elegant solution than some of the other things we're talking about. If it's an automobile mounted antenna for XM or Sirius service, let's call it Sirius, I see that as a much more troublesome way to go, Eugene, on an automobile to try to get higher gain and still have enough angular coverage of that hemisphere of the universe that's above your automobile as you drive in various places. That's a more difficult requirement. So give us a few more words there, Eugene, as to what is your intention. You want a better antenna, but why? Better antenna for the car, better antenna from home, better antenna during a rainstorm. Give us a few more words. W2EWK, K2RIW. You got an interesting question, man, Eugene. You got it.
Okay, W2EWK. I just want something to out. The car is no problem. I tried to find a house, I just said, the satellite antenna, but sometimes it's very hard to go in the station. And sometimes when it rains, it's very hard to go in the station.
deep.
Well, I'll go without it. Okay, so it's home installation and you want higher reliability and you're getting placing reception now, particularly in the rain. Once you realize that these satellites are above you at certain angles, try to find a location for the antenna where it can see clear sky without looking for trees. It would be extremely helpful. It will make a difference. Even using the exact same antenna, properly installed. Let's assume now that preamp, if it's got one attached to it, is properly working. It's getting its D-plus through the coax cable or whatever, and you got a good piece of coax cable going from the roof-mounted antenna down to the receiver. Just putting the antenna itself on the roof of the house, as opposed to inside the house, in my opinion, is going to make a huge reception improvement in reliability. The next step beyond that is to make sure you choose just the right location on the roof that sees the maximum amount of sky from zenith all the way down to the horizon, if it was an ideal environment. Well, we tend to build houses on Long Island that have a lot of trees around them. And when it comes to satellite reception, trees are extremely troublesome. You take your DirecTV and dish network type signal with the 18-inch dish. When that dish is aimed at the right point in the sky, there better not be one single branch of one single tree in the beam of that antenna. Otherwise, you're going to be hurting. And you would think it's because of insertion loss of the tree.
Yeah,
that's a slight factor. It's not the dominant factor. The dominant factor is that the tree is a hot object as far as the cryogenic front end of your receiver is concerned. The receiver, if it's a real good one, may have a reception at the front end of 50 degrees Kelvin. That tree is at 300 degrees Kelvin. If your eyes operated at that frequency and you looked at the tree, it would be a blazing white object against this dim thing in the background called satellite you're trying to listen to. So until you make that up with a whole lot of extra antenna gain, a tree can be very troublesome. So a person who wants good reception on DirecTV and dish network may have to do some tree trimming or movement of the dish. And even if the dish worked beautifully last year, because those trees are continuing to grow, you may start getting flaky reception this year. And once you understand the principle, making the correct reduction is not that difficult. Another thing that's hard to believe is that in the case of direct satellite dish network and direct TV reception, we all get some slight fades on a heavy, rainy day. And you would think it's the insertion loss of the rain. It's depolarization of the rain. The odd and even channels are clockwise and counterclockwise, circular polarized. And when those raindrops get big enough, they're no longer round objects.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They're no longer round objects, so they start creating cross-coupling between the clockwise signals and the counterclockwise signals. And pretty soon your down converter, your receiver, demodulator network, looks at that garbage and says, I give up. And gives you a frozen picture or nothing at all. So, some interesting technology here. It doesn't surprise me at all that the XM and Sirius service are circular polarized. Because if they were linear polarized, choosing the right linear polarization